for clarity.
Listen for Granite People's music and other local artists here on KPFT.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
To Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM, HD2 Houston's Community Media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Starting off with Your Voice, Your Vote, which I still have a link to for the runoffs. FYI, because I do this, early voting for the runoffs started Monday the 27th, so a couple of days ago, and we'll be running through December 5th. Runoff or actual runoff voting day, the election day, is Saturday, December 9th. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., except on Sundays when they'll be open 12 to 7. Take note that sample ballots for the runoff will not be available. Actually, they're available now. This is just old text. So you can go to harrisvotes.com and find your sample ballot. And it's entirely possible that other county clerks will, or election clerks will also have access to sample ballots. But apparently we found that for some reason the Secretary of State only has a massive statewide sample ballot.
Yeah.
So may not help you there. The last day for the county clerk to receive a ballot by mail application was November 28th. So it is now too late. If you didn't already mail an application by approximately November 23rd at the latest, it likely did not arrive on time. I will tell you, though, from my personal example, for those people who are like concerned about turnaround times and will they receive it and process it, my personal example, because they had lost my earlier mail application, I sent one in right after the last election, sent it in around the 17th. The HarrisVotes.com website, which has a tracking app for your mail-in ballot, it says they got my application on 11/22. They processed that application on 11/22, and they put my mail-in ballot in the mail on 11/22, which all of that I find especially mind-blowing. I can't respond to mail and return mail that fast most of the time. and I do it electronically.
Yeah.
Now, the ballot that they sent on the 22nd hit my mailbox on Saturday the 25th. I put it in the mail on Monday the 27th. Presumably that was a Monday, but late. So they'll probably have picked it up on Tuesday the 28th. I feel pretty confident that even with Louis DeJoy running the USPS, it'll probably get there on time. Your mileage, as they say, may vary. This experience suggests that mail transit time, at least within the county, is still about 3 to 4 days. So you can use perhaps my personal timeline for whatever it's worth in your postage and balloting considerations. You can visit harrisvotes.com to find your nearest polling location, sample ballot status, or any status of your mail-in ballot or whichever. FYI. If you weren't registered to vote for the original election November, what was it, 3rd, 4th?
7th?
7th. There is not time for you to have registered for this runoff election because you have to be registered at least 30 days before an active election. However,
and they didn't announce it 30 days before the end of the after the end of the whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to give the Harris County government a little credit here. Screwed over by the state that it's like amazing they got any of this done because they had to change everything on September 1st.
100%.
Absolutely. Like 8 weeks before the election. So kudos, man. Kudos. But what I was going to finish with, if you were registered to vote in the November 7th election but did not, you may still vote if you so desire, and you should desire. You may still vote in the runoff, even if you didn't vote originally in the general election. It's kind of like if you vote in a primary. This is the same case applies. If there is a primary election, and if there is a runoff in the primary, just because you didn't vote in a primary doesn't mean you can't vote in the runoff if you were properly registered for both. So this is really important stuff to remember. Let's see what else we got here. Okay. In terms of, I was going to say output, which is not quite the word I'm looking for. In terms of turnout, that's the output would be like if we could manufacture voters. as with most local off-year runoff elections, turnout is expected to be extremely low in like the 10% range of registered voters. So if you always like your vote to have like a really disproportionately important impact on an election, this is your election. So consider that when you go voting. Andrew?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just the mayoral race that's on this ballot, by the way.
The
city controller race and 4 at-large city council positions should be on the ballot everywhere in Houston.
And just in Houston. There are runoffs also in Bel Air and other places.
Right, and you might have other down-ballot races in the runoff, too. So even if you couldn't care less who becomes mayor of Houston, maybe still look up your sample ballot at the link provided at thinkwingradio.com on the blog post for this episode, anyway, to see if there's anyone on there who you do want to win or want to lose.
And also just consider some people don't like to vote out of a misguided sense of protest. When you don't vote at a protest, all you're doing is letting someone else vote for you, essentially. So even if you're choosing the cream of the crop, I'm not going to say the other word because I'm not sure where that is on the 7 deadly words. But even if you're not going to, even if you're only voting for the cream of the crop, you're still making an active choice as opposed to letting someone else make an active choice while you passively pass the buck.
To provide a balance to that point of view, I do think it's legitimate if people are so disgusted by the American electoral system that they don't want to vote in it. I think that's legitimate, though I do still advocate for, if you're in that position, consider voting third party because it's going to matter more.
You know what? If you don't like anybody, if you don't like the Democrats or the Republicans, the Libertarians or the Greens, or the, you know, and maybe the Nazis aren't on the ballot, Maybe just write in somebody. You know, it's not impossible to write in like Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck or He-Man. You know, it won't count, but you've shown the effort to go there and do it, and that counts for something politically speaking.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, next story is from thecron.com, which I suppose means it's got a higher chance of not being paywalled, and it wasn't. Former Garden Oak Sears to be demolished and transformed into new development. The property has remained mostly vacant since 2020 when the Sears location shuttered, according to reports by Houston Public Media. The defunct Sears store, which has sat vacant at 4000 North Shepherd Drive in North Houston for the last 3 years, will soon be demolished to make way for a mixed-use development, according to Houston Public Media's Adam Zuvanich, I'm not sure. A subsidiary of LeMaser Capital acquired the 11.6-acre property earlier this fall. The Sugarland-based developer recently announced its plans to transform the parcel, which includes the abandoned department store and a former auto repair shop, into a new space for both commercial and residential use. Nothing specific has been shared regarding the site's future tenants, but Lamassar Capital representatives posted on LinkedIn that more information will be announced soon. Although the cost of the land deal was undisclosed, the Harris County Central Appraisal District place the property's value north of $15.5 million per Zuvanich. He said, our vision for a vibrant mixed-use development in this thriving neighborhood aims to create not just residences, but also a spectrum of destinations and services. Actually, this was said by Lamar Capital co-founder Ashiq Ali in a news release. Our goal is to establish a legacy that integrates innovation and serves the community and becomes a focal point for the neighborhood's growth and prosperity for years to come. Yeah, legacy. We may touch on that point in a little bit. In an added statement, Fidelis CEO Alan Hassenflew said the location in Houston's Garden Oaks neighborhood marks a prime investment opportunity to meet the area's growing demand. According to Jeffrey, the former Sears store had operated there for more than 70 years before finally shuttering in 2020. Now, for those of you who grew up when Sears was the Walmart of its day, but better, this is a sad but inevitable outcome for this site. It's prime real estate after all, but this store wasn't a cookie-cutter mall store. This building is something of an architectural landmark in the neighborhood, and I hope something of it can be preserved. Andrew?
Well, not having been around that area, I had to look the building up to see what it looks like. Of course, it's on Google Maps Street View, but that only goes back to 2007. The really interesting images I had to work for. I found a page on Preservation Houston's website about the North Shepherd Sears. There's a detailed photo of the sign, but a little lower on the page is a 1950 design concept drawing of the store. There will be links to a number of the things I mentioned here, by the way, on the blog at thinkwingradio.com. That drawing is attributed to the Houston Chronicle. This concept is also taken from that corner, drawn from that corner, but there seem to be plenty of windows on the ground floor and all kinds of materials used in the facade on the upper part of the building, which I think looks spectacular. I also found a much smaller photo, also seemingly from the 50s or 60s, which shows the store in its heyday. Still plenty of windows on the ground floor, though it seems like the upper facade didn't make it into the final construction. Even so, this would be a unique and fun-looking building to have back. As it is today, having seen the building on Street View from different angles over the years, I have to say that most of the outside has been left fairly bland. I think the really iconic part of the building is that corner where the Sears sign still stands. If the developers have to make more room, I would hope that they could at least keep the pieces of the building that make up that corner, and of course the original Sears sign, which I think would be so easy to keep and maintain that there's no reason to tear it down even if the whole building goes. But if Preservation Houston or a similar organization could get the building designated as a local landmark and save it from destruction, I'd like to see the store restored to its original design from the 50s, upper facade included. I'm sure they could update the building to meet modern code while they're at it and use the area inside for some of that retail space they want to plan for. Kind of like a mall atmosphere, but at a smaller, cozier scale. I think that'd be nice. If they build a multi-story parking garage or two on some of the old parking lot, they could use the rest of the lot for new construction. The developers get their new development, and Houston gets to keep a little bit of its culture. Everyone wins.
Yeah, you know, many buildings have gradually sealed up doors and windows to limit access because of security concerns. But, Andrew, I really, especially since this was not in your area of geography, you had never seen it or known of it, but I really love so much that you did the research and saw what I saw in the building, even seeing it for the first time. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. No problem.
Okay. You are listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., re-airing Thursdays at 6, and re-airing Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show on Google Podcasts, which I recommend, which can be downloaded from both the Android and iPhone Apple stores. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click the show posts and more tab at the top of the web page and find the post for the show you're interested in. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type words into the search bar. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes text if there is one or maybe two particular topics in which you might be especially interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Thinkwing Radio, plus Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story gets a little convoluted. I think it's an important story. It has to do with press freedom. But I'll clarify some of the twists and turns at the end. Just, you know, do the best you can. It's a little confusing. In Alabama, and this is actually a story that we did discuss a couple of months ago when it first cropped up in the news. This is more of a follow-on. In Alabama, another small town paper hit an open season on free press. In an increasingly familiar drama, local authorities go after journalists and publishers of small papers, which find themselves on the First Amendment's front lines. When Don Fletcher checked the mailbox outside his newspaper's office on Main Street in late September, he found a little gold mine waiting for him. Folded up inside was a copy of a grand jury subpoena served on two employees of the local school system. The confidential document indicated that a criminal investigation into potential financial abuse was underway, a solid lead for a veteran reporter like Fletcher. It took a couple of weeks to confirm, but Fletcher soon broke the news in the weekly Atmore News that officials were probing the Escambia County Board of Education, Escambia County Board of Education's handling of federal COVID-19 relief funds. What happened next, though, lifted Fletcher's story far beyond this town nestled amid cotton fields north of the Florida Panhandle. Days later, the local district attorney ordered the arrest of Fletcher and his boss, publisher and part owner Sherry Digman. He charged them both with violating a state law that prohibits the disclosure of grand jury information, a felony punishable by up to 3 years in prison. The reporter, 69, and publisher, 72, were taken to the county lockup by police officers they had known for years. As a courtesy, the deputies waited until they were out of public view before placing handcuffs on them. Nice and thoughtful. The arrests shocked legal scholars and press advocates who say it's a violation of the First Amendment to prosecute a newspaper for reporting the news. More specifically, they argue that District Attorney Stephen M. Billy misapplied Alabama's secrecy law, which criminalizes leaks by anyone directly involved with a grand jury, which is to say, jurors, witnesses, and court officials, but not news outlets that publish the information. American courts have consistently upheld the right to publish leaks as long as the information is obtained lawfully. Of course, that's sort of a contradiction because it's obtained unlawfully, but it's passed along lawfully. So that's part of where it starts to get tricky. The most famous precedent is the Supreme Court's 1971 decision that cleared the way for the New York Times and the Washington Post to publish the classified Pentagon Papers. The Atmore case is alarming because it criminalizes reporting, said Kirsten McCudden, a vice president of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. The incident, she said, is part of a recent string of crackdowns on the press from Marion, Kansas, where police raided the local newspaper and its editor-publisher's home to seize evidence after an allegation of illegally accessed state records, to Waverly, Ohio, where an editor was charged with illegal wiretapping from publishing audio testimony from a murder trial, to Calumet City, Illinois, where city officials sanctioned a reporter for his persistent questioning. Even though judges or other local officials eventually dismissed or dropped these other recent cases, the effect can be damaging. An arrest can harm a journalist's reputation, run up legal bills that drain a vulnerable news outlet's coffers, and deter other reporters from pursuing important stories. Kathy Keeley, a University of Missouri journalism professor who specializes in media law issues, sees two forces driving the trend. The financial decline of the news media has emboldened elected officials who no longer fear challenging once powerful local institutions, and the partisanship of social media has persuaded some officials that the only legitimate news coverage is praiseworthy and unaggressive. It's no coincidence that several of these episodes have occurred in small towns like Marion and Atmore. Far from the hubs of national media that endured attacks on the free press from Donald Trump and his allies, local officials may not be aware of these kinds of press protections because they've dealt with these crises so infrequently, said Bruce D. Brown, executive director of the Reporters Committee of Freedom for the Press. The backstory of the Atmore arrests involves complicated interpersonal entanglements and political feuds in a rural county, population 36,669, where the personal and professional lives of community leaders sometimes crisscross. Digman, the publisher and co-owner of the Atmore News, also has a second job as one of the seven elected members of the Escambia County Board of Education. Many newsrooms have prohibitions on staff members becoming involved in politics or local government because of the potential for conflict between the two roles. Digman's dual responsibilities to the school board and to the newspaper that sometimes covers the school board created the tension at the heart of her battle with D.A. Billy. But Billy wasn't through with Digman. 5 days after her arrest, the grand jury issued a second warrant, this one charging her with two more felonies, this time for corruption and moral turpitude in her conduct as a school board member. The prosecutor alleged that Digman used her position on the school board to pressure staff to buy ads in her publications. She was arrested again. On November 3rd, the grand jury issued a report signed by D.A. Billy that recommended Digman be impeached and removed from the school board. The report's language was both blunt and insinuating. It accused Digman of neglecting her official duties by skipping some school-related events while selectively attending others. A quote is anonymously included, saying she always attends school conferences accompanied by her female business partner, spending several thousand dollars.
I believe that's a quote from the report prepared.
Oh, okay. It further alleged that Digman turned against McClung after the superintendent began questioning the ad buys. While Digman and Fletcher agreed to meet a Washington Post reporter for an off-the-record conversation, they have declined public comment on their cases. Their reticence is compelled by their bail terms set by a judge, which prohibit them from publishing stories about the grand jury or the school board until the information is on the public record. Brown of the Reporters Committee questioned the gag order, saying it is functionally an act of prior restraint, preventing the journalists from reporting what they may turn up through their own investigative efforts. That hasn't stopped them from reporting the very public details about themselves and their own legal peril, even while awaiting their own arraignment. The notion that Escambia County is a small place was brought home in the aftermath of the journalists' arrests. Ernest Ray White is an attorney for Digman. The county's two circuit judges and a district judge all recused themselves, citing prior professional relationships and social friendships with the defendants and the district attorney. All three judges previously worked for Billy in the district attorney's office, while one is also White's nephew, who worked in his uncle's firm for 10 years. The lawyer for the school official is White's brother. In the meantime, Sherry Digman has said she has no plans to quit either of her two jobs. Now, I promised I was going to try to clarify this story and make sense of what it's about and why I'm including it. So here is where we start. This is a follow-up story to a story that we discussed, I believe, back in September, maybe early October. I tried to shorten this article further, but the issues, the ethics, and the relationships are so convoluted that cutting more would have made the story even more challenging to understand. In summation, though, I see this as coming down essentially to four questions. One, when is it legal to publish illegally divulged information? Two, ethical conflicts of interest. Three, possible malicious prosecution. And four, prior restraint on reporting and free speech. Those are, I think, the four major issues in play here. The possibility of malicious prosecution by D.A. Billy is explained more in the body of the story, but the motive is still left unclear. The mention of the 1971 Pentagon Papers precedent is critical to understanding this story because it made clear that publishing secret information is not itself necessarily illegal, as long as the reporter neither instigated nor participated in the illegal accessing of the secret documents. That's a really, really important point that needs to be thought about. The ethical concerns here are probably specific to small-town life, where the whole county has fewer than 37,000 people, but are nonetheless a microcosm of how subtle and challenging it can be to untangle ethics in personal and professional relationships. The question of prior restraint regarding further reporting is perhaps especially interesting, given Donald Trump's efforts to quash any gag orders levied against him while awaiting trials. The story doesn't suggest that issue is yet resolved in this case. But the overarching issue in this case, and the others cited in Marion, Kansas, and Waverly, Ohio, is that of a free press and the chilling effect that government interference, even if eventually determined to be illegal, can have on a free press. Such interference can cumulatively have the effect of essentially becoming prior restraint by intimidating reporters and news-gathering institutions from legal costs of certain reporting, basically self-censorship. I once read an article, and I have linked to it, from 2004. It was an article about a Chinese investigative reporter who learned this the hard way. When being interviewed at the end of all the trials and tribulations, literally and figuratively, he had been through, he said something I've always remembered all these years, a couple of decades, about the lesson he took away from his experience. Freedom means knowing how big your cage is. And our question here, is that the lesson we want our legitimate press to learn, Andrew?
I think these stories show that it's already a lesson that applies here, too. Let's also remember that restrictions on the press don't have to rely on the force of law. While in office, Trump famously revoked press passes for a major chunk of the White House press corps by changing an internal attendance policy and made reporters apply for exceptions to that policy, which could be denied if Trump or then press secretary Sarah Sanders didn't like the reporters or their outlets. The idea that government officials at all levels can kill unfavorable stories with threats and bribery is also widely known in this country. What we've all rapidly learned in the past few years is that no freedom given by law is guaranteed or unrestricted. Sometimes those restrictions are reasonable, but often they are not. This is true everywhere in the world, so every government should be equally scrutinized on what restrictions they place on the freedoms they give. In other words, the fight for a free press happens just as much here at home as it does abroad.
Good points. The constitutions of many autocracies, including Russia, for example, have lots of freedom guarantees in principle, but not in practice.
I think some civil rights lawyers would argue the same is true here in the U.S.
And you'll get no argument from me on that. Okay, our next story is from LiveScience.com. Measles deaths jumped over 40% from 2021 to 2022, as reported by the CDC. Declines in measles vaccination during the COVID-19 pandemic have been tied to an uptick in measles cases, deaths, and major outbreaks worldwide. Measles cases, deaths, and outbreaks jumped dramatically between 2021 and 22, a new report from the World Health Organization, or WHO, as well as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, show. The research published Friday, November 17th in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, the MMWR, revealed an 18% rise in the estimated number of measles cases between 2021 and 22. That's an increase of about 7.8 million cases to 9.2 million cases. Measles deaths increased by 43% globally from 95,000 in 2021 to 136,200 in 2022. The number of countries reporting large or disruptive outbreaks of measles jumped from 22 in 2021 to 37 in 2022, marking a 68% increase. The increase in measles outbreaks and deaths is staggering, but unfortunately not unexpected given the declining vaccination rates we've seen in the past few years, said John Vertifoil, director, again, apologies for pronouncing names, director of the CDC's Global Immunization Division, said in a statement. Measles cases anywhere pose a risk to all countries and communities where people are under-vaccinated. Urgent, targeted efforts are critical to prevent measles disease and deaths. Between 2000 and 2019, vaccine coverage with the first MMR dose, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, rose from 72% to 86% worldwide. One dose of MMR vaccine is 93% effective against measles, while two doses are 97% effective. But in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic hit, coverage fell to just 83%, and in 2021 it dropped further to 81%, according to MMWR. Global coverage increased to 83% in 2022 as some countries rebounded from pandemic setbacks, but in low-income countries, vaccination rates continued to fall. From 2019 to 2021, coverage in low-income countries fell from 71% to 67%, and then in 2022 to 66%, the MMWR states. Of 22 million children who missed their first MMR vaccine dose in 2022, more than half live in 10 countries: Angola, Brazil, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia, India, Indonesia, Madagascar, Nigeria, Pakistan, and the Philippines. Might note on the side that the reasons for the difficulties in getting vaccines to people and their children geographically are different for each country. It can be mountainous, it can be full of islands, a lot of different reasons, but it boils down to the same thing. Going on with the story, the lack of recovery in measles vaccine coverage in low-income countries following the pandemic is an alarm bell for action, said Dr. Kate O'Brien, the WHO's Director for Immunization, Vaccine, and Biologicals, in a statement. Worldwide coverage with the second MMR dose was 74% in 2022. Coverage with both the first and second doses needs to be 95% to protect communities from outbreaks, according to the CDC. Now, I have said this same thing. I don't want to say I'm preaching to the choir, but I think I'm preaching to the choir, that before antibiotics, there were vaccines. In my opinion, vaccines were probably the most significant preventative for disease in human history, followed only by antibiotics, and probably they still are. The most important health advance before that was good basic public hygiene, like hand washing with soap and water, which I see absent, by the way, in many instances in public restrooms. We just never learn. Measles is transmitted human to human. There is no intermediate vector. It can be from physical contact, indirect contact, like a doorknob or a sink or something of that nature. If MMR vaccinations become nearly universal around the world, measles can be made as extinct as smallpox. In the wealthy countries, anti-vaxxers continue to be a reservoir for measles and other preventable diseases. For these folks, I don't believe that education helps because they refuse to be educated. In poor countries, greater efforts must be made for vaccines of all types to be made as available as possible. Andrew?
I agree. Unfortunately, a lot of the Global South doesn't trust Western governments and institutions due to a long history of colonialism, and that extends to things like vaccination. While I can't blame them for that mistrust, it is still important for people in those countries to be vaccinated, both for their own health and everyone else's. I think public trust in vaccines needs to be bolstered in those parts of the world. International bodies need to not only educate the public on how vaccines are safe and effective, but also ensure that Global South nations are playing key roles in international oversight of vaccine production and producing vaccines domestically rather than relying on the West for all their doses. The more people in the Global South trust and take vaccines, the safer they and everyone on Earth will be.
Yeah, some of that has to do with, like, patents and proprietary processes, and of course, restricting the supply keeps profits up. So I think that there are probably some international and corporate negotiations that would have to take place there. But yeah, I think that that Definitely. Is one way.
Yeah.
I do have a reference regarding the measles report from 9 August of 2023 from the WHO. So that's there if anyone wants to look at it. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. Central, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Central. Re-airing, as it were. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community radio, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too. And it's free. Okay, our next story has to do with the COP28, which is the climate something.
The Conference of Parties, I think.
Okay, thank you. But it is climate. It's just not part of the COP.
Yes.
So Conference of Parties 28. Australia offers refuge to Pacific Island nation threatened by rising sea levels. This is from CNBC.com. Australia and the South Pacific Island nation of Tuvalu are to forge closer ties thanks to a new agreement covering areas including security, migration, and climate change. The Australia-Tuvalu-Philippi Union, a bilateral treaty, sees Australia pledging to create, quote, a special mobility pathway that will enable Tuvaluans to go to Australia to work, study, and live. To start with, the number of Tuvaluans eligible to go to Australia will be capped at 280 a year. With a population of just over 11,000 people, Tuvalu is extremely vulnerable to the impact of climate change, especially rising sea levels, and is trying to preserve its culture, traditions, and land, the Australian government said in a statement. The pact also includes an Australian pledge to provide assistance to Tuvalu in response to a major natural disaster, health pandemics, and military aggression. In addition, both countries have made a commitment to mutually agree on any partnership, arrangement, or engagement with any other state or entity on security and defense-related matters in Tuvalu. Made up of nine islands, Tuvalu, as the Australian government statement notes, is seriously threatened by the effects of climate change, and Tuvalu's Department of Foreign Affairs describes climate change as, quote, one of the most existential security risks currently threatening the country. The deal on migration is significant and highlights how countries are having to find solutions to deal with the considerable effects of climate change. This agreement probably has not gotten the coverage it deserves, but it's probably precedent setting for our age of climate change caused by global warming. Australia is a sparsely populated country about the size of the U.S. with about 27 million people and an annual GDP per capita of about $65,000 a year. It's always looking for immigrants, but usually limits immigration to people with marketable skills and/or financial resources that can be self-supporting while helping to develop the country economically. Tuvalu is a small island nation of about 12,000 people with an annual GDP per capita income of about $3,000 to $3,600 a year. These are U.S. dollar calculations. That wealth difference is one of the things that makes this agreement so significant, in my opinion. There is not a powerful economic incentive for Australia to create an immigration path for Tuvaluans, so it's not entirely altruistic, but it's nonetheless a win-win for both sides. Depending on sea level rises, more or fewer Tuvaluans will have a path to safety and perhaps greater opportunity. Australia gets moral points on the international political stage and possibly a new source of entry-level labor, while also expanding its international reach and security in the Southern Pacific. If countries look in new ways at the impacts of sea level rise on peoples with nowhere to go, it may lead to more agreements creating potential escape routes for populations of distinct island nations. Andrew?
Well, it's not bad to have as an escape route, but ideally, Tuvaluans wouldn't need to use it. I hope these refuge agreements don't start taking the place of agreements and commitments to reduce carbon emissions and help stop climate change from creating the conditions that people would have to take refuge from.
Well, metaphorically speaking, I think that ship has sailed. The world is now dealing with mitigation as part of its strategy, but as you say, it can only be a part.
That ship, as it were. It depends on how you measure it, but some experts still say that we have about 8 years before we hit the point of no return. Even if we do pass it, losing hope will just make mitigation harder. We may as well keep trying to stop and reverse climate change, whether we think it's possible or not. But yes, fallback measures like this agreement should be part of that effort.
Also, the point of no return is kind of a different concern. Even if we would have hit net zero on CO2 emissions today, there is still inertia in the climate change we're experiencing, considering it's something like a ballistic missile trajectory. After the engine shut down, the missile keeps going even as it falls to the ground. That's why humans need to be addressing climate change from a variety of directions: mitigation, migration, greenhouse gas reduction, etc.
Ah, so the ship of avoiding mitigation is the one that has sailed, not the ship of reversing climate change. Well, that we can agree on. And speaking of missiles.
Nice segue. Thank you. From the New York Times, how Ukraine, with no warships, is thwarting Russia's navy. The commander of Ukraine's navy said in a rare interview that the Russian naval blockade of Odessa had been broken. He also described how the war is transforming naval tactics. In a small hidden office in the port city of Odessa, the commander of the Ukrainian navy keeps two trophies representing successes in the Black Sea. One is the lid from the missile tube used in April 2022 to sink the flagship of the Russian Black Sea fleet, the Moskva, a devastating blow that helped chase the Russian Black Sea fleet warships from the Ukrainian coast. On the lid is a painting of a Ukrainian soldier raising his middle finger to the ship as it burst into flames. The other is a key used to arm a British-made Storm Shadow missile that slammed into the headquarters of a Russian fleet in Sevastopol on the Crimean Peninsula. Despite having no warships of its own, Ukraine has, over the course of the war, shifted the balance of power in the naval conflict. Its use of unmanned maritime drones and a growing arsenal of long-range anti-ship missiles, along with critical surveillance provided by Western allies and targeted assaults by Ukraine's Air Force and Special Operations Forces, have allowed Ukraine to blunt the advantages of the vastly more powerful Russian Navy. At this point, the Russian Black Sea Fleet is primarily what naval strategists term a fleet in being, which is to say it represents a potential threat that needs to be vigilantly guarded against, but one that remains in check for now, said Scott Savitz, a senior engineer at the RAND Corporation, a federally financed center that conducts research for the U.S. military. Remarkably, Ukraine has achieved all this without a substantial fleet of its own. Ukraine has nevertheless managed to negate some of Russia's advantages and lately has gone on the offensive. Over the last 2 months, it has launched both stealthy nighttime operations by small units on jet skis and powerful missile strikes. Those strikes have hit not just the Sevastopol headquarters, but also a Kilo-class submarine and a shipbuilding plant in eastern Crimea, an attack that damaged a new missile-carrying Russian warship. The latter strike will likely cause Russia to consider relocating farther from the front line, the British military intelligence agency reported. The war at sea has also demonstrated the impact of emerging technologies, transforming long-held theories about naval warfare in ways that are being studied around the world, perhaps nowhere more closely than in China and Taiwan. The classical approach that we studied at military maritime academies does not work now, Ukrainian Vice Admiral Oleksiy Najpapel said. Therefore, we have to be as flexible as possible and change approaches to planning and implementing work as much as possible. For example, he said, it takes years to develop and build warships and more time to update them to meet new challenges. Yet maritime drones are evolving every month. While much attention over the past 20 months has focused on the land war, Europe's largest since World War II, a desire to control the Black Sea was a key factor in President Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. In 2014, when Russia illegally annexed Crimea, Ukraine lost nearly all of its ships, about 5,000 of its sailors defected, and cut the size of its navy by two-thirds. Admiral Nezhpapa is fond of citing an adage of Alfred Thayer Mahan, the famed American naval officer and historian, that a nation must defend its own coast, starting from the coast of its enemy. Andrew?
I'm choosing to interpret that adage as being about not limiting naval defense to just what's on the water, because otherwise, well, your own side in war isn't the only one that can launch a preemptive strike. We've talked many times since the invasion began about how the war in Ukraine would change the participants and the world, and this article is another side in that discussion. I doubt naval warfare never thought to consider land-based targets or defenses before 2022, but if this isn't the first time that a naval strategy relied mostly on non-water-based means, I'll be very surprised. I expect Ukraine's naval strategy will be studied in military academies and rebel tactical meetings around the world for years to come.
I think the point of the story is how asymmetrical coastal naval warfare has become in terms of costs, lead times, and improved capabilities development. It changes the math between countries with a significant navy and countries without. In naval terms, it's called access denial, basically making it too risky for expensive capital ships to engage close to shore. The UK used a similar strategy during the 1982 Falklands War between the UK and Argentina, although the strategy was based more on disinformation. Argentina had invaded and occupied the Falklands, and the UK sent a naval task force to respond, but had no other naval assets in the vicinity. In order to restrict the Argentine Navy's operations in the region, the UK claimed it had submarines in the area that would sink Argentine ships. This was a strategy of access denial, although the UK actually had no subs in the area. Nonetheless, it kept Argentine warships in port or close to shore. Access denial was the strategy, although information warfare was the means to accomplish it. Ukraine's strategy of access denial, by showing its ability to inflict unexpected damage on Russian warships in an important is an important strategic accomplishment, and shows how the balance of power between a significant naval power and a nation with very little naval capability can change quickly in an age of robotic warfare. By the way, I've linked to a Wikipedia article on the Falklands War for those who are curious. It was pretty costly on both sides for a 10-day war. I think it's time for our last break.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m., and re-airing Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs, and listening at your leisure. We heavily excerpt most stories on the show, which is why we include links to the full stories on the show posts and more page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and, importantly, help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
Indeed I do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is from Politico.com. Ukraine is open to the possibility of attacking Russia's oil and gas infrastructure if Moscow ramps up its targeting of Ukraine's electrical system this winter, Ukraine Energy Minister German Galushenko said in an interview. Galushenko, speaking with Politico in Washington, D.C., after meeting with the Biden administration officials and lawmakers, said Russia has regularly perpetrated cyber attacks against Ukraine's electric grid and is expected to ramp up physical attacks as temperatures fall and people depend more on energy to heat their homes. His comments came after Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said last month Ukraine, which has launched multiple attacks against Russian targets, would respond if Russia stepped up attacks on his country's power grid this winter. This could open the door to the possibility that the European conflict could add more turmoil to global energy markets. When asked if Zelensky's response could include Ukraine targeting Russia's vast oil and gas operations, by far the biggest driver of its economy, Galushchenko replied, "It would only be fair." When answering Russia's attack, we would answer by taking the same approach, attacking their energy infrastructure, Galushchenko said. Galushchenko stressed he was not a member of the Ukraine military and did not discuss the possible targeting of Russian energy operations with U.S. government officials. He is a member of the Ukraine National Security and Defense Council. Europe has already significantly cut its reliance on Russian oil and natural gas, largely thanks to imports of U.S. liquefied natural gas. But Russia still sells large volumes of its fossil fuels to China and India, helping to keep a lid on global oil prices. Galushchenko downplayed the idea that attacking Russia's ability to produce or ship its oil and gas would cause a spike in prices, saying other producers would make up the supply. Attacks to the infrastructure would not be so critical for the prices, especially when you're talking about oil and gas, Galushchenko said. I mean, those are the fuels which you could buy not only in Russia, I'm sure the world could manage. Germany and other European countries are also facing a gas glut as warm weather has offset the need for so much LNG that it purchased in response to fears of a shortage last winter that did not materialize. Investigators have not yet identified who perpetrated the September 2022 sabotage that took out Russia's Nord Stream pipeline that carried gas from Russia to Europe, But German investigators earlier this year said they found traces of evidence indicating that Ukrainian citizens may have been involved. Galushchenko said he also pushed for sanctions targeting Russia's nuclear industry, including state-controlled nuclear energy company Rosatom, to force Russian personnel to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear plant complex that its military captured in early 2022. Nuclear fuel and technology is still one of Russia's biggest exports, even as the United States and Europe have cut their imports of Russian oil and gas. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on Russian nuclear fuel and technology in purchases that critics say fund Moscow's war efforts. And I do have a link to that story. That is an in-story link to the U.S. buying nuclear fuel from Russia that's both interesting and surprising. But this gets back to my earlier comment about the world being in a wartime economy, not necessarily in this show, but in shows previously. If Ukraine feels provoked to a point of attacking Russian energy infrastructure that could raise energy prices fairly quickly once stored supplies shrink, unless the difference is made up somewhere else. Andrew?
I think that was a comment made in last week's show specifically. I think the effects of an attack on Russian energy infrastructure would be most prominently felt at the relatively local level. Other nations that import oil and gas from Russia, such as Germany, would probably feel the squeeze first and slash or most, but such an attack would shrink the global supply of those fuels to some degree, which would have knock-on effects as the price for the now more limited supply goes up. Most nations of the world would probably feel that to some degree, if not all of them.
In another story on the COP28 meeting, rare earth discoveries mean coal mines could have a key role to play in the energy transition. From Pennsylvania to the north of England, coal mines helped to power the Industrial Revolution, turbocharging the economic growth of countries around the world. Today, however, the production and use of coal has become a thorny issue, with critics slamming the fossil fuel's huge impact on the environment. As the debate surrounding coal continues, discussions about using it and the infrastructure linked to it in the shift to a more sustainable future have become one of the more paradoxical aspects of the energy transition. In May, U.S. firm Ramaco Resources offered some insight into how coal may have a role to play in the years ahead. Together with researchers from mining consultancy Ware International and the U.S. Department of Energy's National Energy Technology Laboratory, it published an independent report containing a technical assessment of rare earth elements, or REE, found at one of its mines in Wyoming. The findings appear to be significant. It says following 18 months of extensive core drilling and independent chemical analysis, NETL researchers and Ramaco now believe that the Brook Mine property contains perhaps the largest unconventional deposit of REEs discovered in the United States, Ramaco said. With China dominating the supply and refining of rare earths, discoveries like the one in Wyoming could be strategically pivotal as the race to roll out the technologies of tomorrow heats up. The majority of REE deposits outside of China are associated with so-called conventional mines and found in igneous hard rock deposits, which makes them both difficult and expensive to mine and process, Ramaco said. In contrast, the REEs from the Brook Mine are characterized as unconventional. They added, because they are largely found in clay strata located above and below the coal seams themselves. It is expected they can be mined using normal surface mining techniques and processed in a more economic and environmental manner than conventional REE mines. Wyoming is not the only part of the U.S. where coal and rare earth extraction are being looked at. In April, for instance, West Virginia University said its researchers would receive an $8 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. The funding would allow them to carry on with the development and advancement of a pioneering method to extract and separate rare earth elements and critical minerals from acid mine drainage and coal waste, it added. Elsewhere, researchers at Penn State have also been focusing on ways to source rare earths and critical minerals via waste from coal mines. While the article doesn't mention this specifically, one of the interesting things about rare earths is the term itself is a misnomer. Rare earths aren't actually rare, but they are hard to access economically and can generate a lot of environmental damage and pollution to access and process. As they are increasingly seen as strategic materials, sourcing them domestically is taking a much higher national priority. Any benefit to repurposing coal mines as suppliers of rare earths can have many benefits to industry, local economies, and national security. It will be important, though, to apply the lessons from sourcing countries currently like China and avoid making the same environmental mistakes. Andrew?
Yeah, my gut instinct is skepticism, along the lines of the whole clean coal thing. The elements at this particular mine may indeed be less environmentally harmful to harvest, but that doesn't mean retrieving them won't still do harm to the environment. I'm not casting aspersions, but I worry that other mining companies could jump on this idea to claim they should be exempt from environmental regulations because they're, quote, unconventional rare earth elements, i.e. whatever the hell they pull up from their mines, are also, quote, more environmental. I worry more that some people will buy it.
I actually think your analogy to the clean coal farce is perfectly reasonable under the circumstances. I think that the energy industry generally and the coal industry in particular has certainly earned the distrust of people that are concerned about the pollution which is public versus the profits which are private.
Indeed.
In terms of the reference I made about environmental degradation, I've included a link to an article from Yale.edu called China Wrestles with the Toxic Aftermath of Rare Earth Mining, which goes into a little bit more detail about what's involved and the prices they've had to pay environmentally, and that it might take 50 to 100 years to clean up the mess they have created. So their dominance in the market comes at a price. Always good to end on a happy note, right? You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2. We are Houston's community media. My co-host, indispensable editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. So y'all take care.
See you later.
We have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? Not too late, we should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. To the shore, I know we'll be there by tomorrow, and we'll escape the darkness. We won't be searching anymore. There's got to be a morning after.
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 I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Rising seas, high tide flooding, more extreme storms. Miami is already feeling the impacts of climate change, and kids know it.
It's in the news now, and they see it. They're listening. They're seeing things on social media. They see the impacts it has on our communities.
Linda Coolin is a fifth grade teacher at Oliver Hoover Elementary School. To help students understand the problem and help solve it, her school participates in the Green Schools Challenge. The environmental nonprofit Dream and Green runs the program. It provides teachers in Miami-Dade and Broward counties with a free curriculum and ideas for hands-on activities about climate change and sustainability. Kulin students learn about sea level rise by letting ice melt into a kiddie pool, and they create miniature beaches on baking sheets to model erosion. Participating schools also develop their own environmental projects. Some reduce their energy use. At Oliver Hoover, students led a campaign for recycling and reducing the use of plastic.
Those are habits that hopefully, starting now, will be implemented for future generations.
So the program empowers young people with knowledge they can use to help protect the Earth. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
My name is Marcus, and I'm the host of No Expectations. Tune in Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 12 noon for an unpredictable and eclectic mix of music. Expect the unexpected when you tune in with No Expectations. Saturdays at